Thank God for Bitcoin podcast is brought to you by IRS GuardDog. IRS GuardDog is a tax monitoring service that alerts you to existing and even prospective problems that arise with your IRS account. I spoke with Clinton Donnelly, the CEO of IRS GuardDog, the other day, and he shared about a recent client that they had helped who hadn't paid his taxes in 6 years. I'm sure none of our TGFB listeners could ever fathom getting in that kind of situation, but he was, and he needed help getting up to date. So they took a look at his account, and through their service, were able to see that the IRS was preparing to audit him. He brought all his paperwork to Clinton and his team, filed 6 years of tax returns within a couple months, and checked his account a short while later to find that the IRS had actually reversed the decision to audit him, which saved him and his business thousands of dollars in legal fees and a ton of time. IRS GuardDog offers four service tiers, ranging from as little as $12 a month up to $249 a month for full active monitoring, consultation, fix, audit defense, and audit appeal. Clinton is a former pastor and was also one of our presenting sponsors at the Thank God for Bitcoin conference in Miami this past year. Go ahead over to irsguarddog.com and use promo code TGFB. You can find out more there and let them know that you found them via us. That does a lot to help support us as a business and ensure that we can continue to make podcasts like this going forward in the future.
Jared Michaud, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Thanks, Jordan. It's great to be on with you. I've been looking forward to this. I've been hoping we could do this for a while.
So, Jared, so we ran into each other, as you know, most of our interviews do, on Twitter.
Yeah.
And we were going back and forth. I was just looking at you commented on a post that I did about the idea of killing your heroes. And so, you know, just the idea of, you know, there's, especially within Bitcoin Twitter, there's lots of talk about killing your heroes, and there seems to be a lot of zeal over the prospect of killing your heroes. And so in my mind, that seems, again, you shouldn't be excited about killing your heroes. You shouldn't be like running around with your sword ready just to waiting to chop heads off. Like, it should be something that you're willing to do, but it shouldn't be, you know, something that you're super excited about. And I basically compared people who want to do this to child armies. Like, they just run around and they're not able to process, you know, the second and third order consequences of what they're actually thinking about. Then you responded immediately and said, you know, you and I could have a seriously interesting conversation. And so, well, that was the genesis of this conversation. So why don't you kind of introduce yourself for everyone and then maybe get into why that post kind of caught your attention.
Okay. So I'm Jared Michaud. I am, lately, I'm an author. I've written one book. My first book's coming out in April. I've got another one ready behind it and then working on more, some short stories, stuff like that. And the reason for that is that I looked at, I don't know, you know, this kind of started when I was a kid, and I was looking at what can I do to make things better in this world? Because I love the Lord, and I see all of the craziness that's going on, and I wanted to do something that was useful. And, you know, I looked at politics, I looked at all the different things that you look at, and eventually the conclusion I came to is that our stories are broken and have been for 60, 80 years. Mm-hmm. And the best thing I can do, the best thing I can contribute is to get into that. But the reason that particular post caught me was just every time you post on Twitter, I can see how your mind and my mind run along similar lines and how we kind of see the same things going on. And I just thought, you know, it would be so cool to get to talk to you. So thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
No, of course. No, happy to do it. Again, like it's funny because, like, again, probably the two of us, you can hang out in Bitcoiner circles and there's like a ton of overlap. Like, there's a ton of appreciation. We can talk about these things. And then in Christian circles, there's obviously a ton of overlap and you're excited to have those conversations. And you know, obviously that's engaging you in a completely different way. Or to, at least to a depth, you know, maybe that Bitcoin itself doesn't. But then when you there's like this small group of people who are engaging on both those levels and you know, seeing how those points intersect in maybe ways that seem unintuitive to people who have not thought about them. And so when you find people who have thought about those intersections, it's like the best of both worlds.
Oh, it really is. And I kind of almost have to stay away from the Bitcoin topic for this conversation because we'll go down a rabbit hole that we'll never get out of. You wanted to
I'll kind of let you take the wheel here in terms of introducing, what it is that, you wanted to talk about based on that specific tweet, or just, what it made you, what it brought to mind,
So a tiny bit of background on that. The way my mind works, do you think in words or pictures or what? How does your mind work? Because some people think in words, some in pictures, and some other ways.
Yeah, this sounds pretentious. Like, I think in like Bible, like literally, like whenever I'm like, whenever something happens or like I'm reading something, like my mind is just like, okay, like trying to search for something to like attach it to. Like, how do I like just to have a framework to think about things. So that's in a lot of ways, that's kind of like what happens.
Okay. So let me, the way I tend to think is actually in connections. How do things connect together? So that's actually probably closer to what you were just saying.
Yes. And, yes, it is.
So when you bring that up, that tweet, what it wasn't specifically that tweet. It was how it connects with everything else, both from the Christian side and the Bitcoin side and all the different things.
Yeah.
And I guess for me, to go to what I'm sort of interested in, the thing that has been driving me lately. When I started writing this book, I made a Twitter account for the book, the Energemetra 6 Twitter account for this world that I'm creating.
Go follow him. There you go.
A guy, absolutely. If you can spell it, actually the place to go would be e6universe.com. If you're actually interested, e6universe.com.
We'll have both. Yeah, we'll have both of those in the show notes, so people won't have to rely on.
But either way, I found a tweet by a guy who goes by Adam von Neumann's chief of staff. And the tweet was, some guys pick one book and make it their whole personality. For me, it's Starship Troopers. That was what he said. And I could have practically kissed the guy because it's such a perfect illustration of what I've been thinking about, in that stories drive so much of what we do. It's crazy. And I don't think people realize it. So when I was thinking about this conversation, sometimes when I'm like in the shower, God will give me ideas or thoughts and I'll be like, wow, that's amazing. And so one of the ones that I got, I think it was like Saturday or Sunday, was, When I was thinking about this conversation, what I got was, most people don't realize what the world was like before Christ and what changed that, why it changed. So just as an example here, Plutarch was the first one. I actually looked this up last night. Plutarch was the first one to say this. Spartan mothers, when they would send their sons off to war, would say, come back with your shield or on it. And he may have been using poetic license. We don't know. But the point he was making is that the only thing that was respected was strength. It wasn't be safe. It wasn't we love you. It was come back with your shield or come back on it. If you run away, I don't want to ever see you again.
Yeah.
It was courage defines you. Mm. And, Roman society in general was basically, and I'm pointing to Roman society because it gives us sort of a window into everything else at the time, because they weren't that.
You're saying at the time of Christ,
I'm saying back during that era of the world.
Yeah.
Before Christ and up to that time. Yeah. And what we see in that society was that everything was really hierarchical. The master of a house had the right of life and death over everyone in the house. And that was true in other societies too. We know it was true in Jewish society. We know it was true. And, Romans said that barbarians were far less civilized than they were. We know that basically everything was based on power. Might made right.
Yeah.
And you can see that through a lot of different things. One of the great examples was, If you were in a powerful position as a Roman, you could screw whatever you wanted. And I don't mean to be sort of crass here, but the idea is just that they didn't see anything that was, they didn't see things in the terms that we did. There was no, oh, you have to be nice or you're not being moral. There was no, you have to be, you know, this is good. It was all, if you are strong, that is good. And everything flowed from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, another example, we saw in the Bible itself where, you remember where, I don't remember which book it's in, but it talks about Paul casting out a spirit of divination and getting in serious trouble, and people actually wanted to, practically wanted to kill him because he did that. You remember this?
Yeah, as he ruined their, it was with the little girl, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the idea being, though, having that spirit was actually considered a good thing. There was no, there was nothing morally wrong with it in the eyes of society, and he actually just got himself and his companions in serious trouble because he did that.
Yeah. And he took away their ability. I mean, this girl, like, through this evil spirit, was able to tell the future.
Yeah.
And so that was a valuable thing for people. And like, both literal, it been both valuable, you know, just in terms of helpful and valuable monetarily. Like, they were able to monetize. And so when he casts out this demon, you know, then she's no longer able to produce the same monetary benefit to them that she was before.
Right. And you know, even if you come forward to like the 30 Years' War in Europe, there's a book called 1632 that was a really interesting story. It's an alternative history sort of fiction. It wasn't nonfiction. But one of the points that the author really made a point of making there is how brutal everything was.
Yeah.
How brutality was just a way of life. And the morals that we take advantage of or that we take for granted today just didn't exist.
Yeah.
And to me, I think the thing that I saw, I told you I was in the shower and I got these thoughts.
Yeah.
The thing that I saw that sort of crystallized for me, it was the story of Christ that changed this. And I mean that in a technical sense, right? It took the fact of what he did on the cross to make all of the changes that he made. That 3-year ministry and death on the cross for the sake of our sins, the fact of that changed a great deal. But in a technical sense, the story of it was what changed our morality.
Mm.
And here's what I mean by that. When we look at life, when we decide how we're going to live, we don't do it based on facts. We do it based on narrative. That's why God gave us the scriptures, right? In the scriptures, it's a set of stories.
Yeah.
And whether they're in poetic form or whether they're in narrative form or in history form, whatever, we have different genres there, but they're all stories. And the reason that is because he knows that that's what we internalize.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when people started to internalize Christ's story and it called them to a higher level of acting and being, it changed the morality of all of Western society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I think, again, one of the things that makes me think about, so an example would be, you know, the Apostle Paul writing to the Corinthians, and he says, you know, he just talks about how he's talking to a people who were, the, as far as we can tell, the wealthiest among the churches that he wrote to. So it was the church that most, that was most like maybe the had a value system that was most aligned with the broader Roman world. Like it doesn't seem like they were struggling for monetary resources. They weren't suffering persecution to the same degree that these other people were. And like Paul is trying to help them grasp, you know, the difference that Christ makes and how Christ completely turns the world upside down in terms of how he thinks and values. And he just basically says to them, there were not many powerful, there weren't many wise among you. You know, not many of you were, you know, were these great, impressive, you know, outwardly impressive figures, you know, when you came to know Christ. There's, you know, and just like in every church, there seem to be a few. You have wealthier people who, in God's providence, were able to donate money or lands or to, you know, donate their houses to be used for the church to meet in and stuff. But the vast majority of people weren't in that situation. And so Jesus is trying to help them see, like, that's not necessarily, like, that's not something you should now, you know, as in following me, go seek after now. Like, don't think you have to become, you know, these rich, smart people. Like, just, you know, be who you are and stay in the station in which you were called. This is another principle that Paul brings out, is like, don't think that you need to, this is borne out in the story of the Gerasene demoniac. I have a piece at TGF.com where I kind of unpack that story. And like that guy, like he wants to go with Jesus to go be his disciple. He wants to follow him, which is such a rare thing. He's like, I want to leave my family. I want to leave everything to follow you, Jesus. And Jesus tells him, no, I want you to stay right where you're at. I want you to stay and go
to
tell your, what'd you say?
I actually listened to your piece on that last
night. Oh, no way. Oh, cool. Yeah. So he just basically says, you know, like, stay here and tell your family and your neighbors how much God has done for you.
Yeah.
And so again, like, this idea, like, it's radically different, and maintaining that radical difference, just, it looks like staying in the place where you're at and not necessarily thinking you need to make all these big, you know, moves and flashy changes in your life.
Sure. Well, and it's the testimony, it's the story that made those changes in his friends and his neighbors, right? It's like, it was that story of what God did for him.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Okay. So what I was going to say, what we see there is, when I think about myth, that to me is what Christ did is sort of the core of myth. It's the true story that made all the other stories, I don't know how to put it exactly, but in that one story, it brought all of the other stories into focus. It made everything else have its purpose and its meaning.
Yeah. Why don't you unpack the word myth for us? Because I know the sense you're talking about, you're talking about like in a Lewisian sense, C.S. Lewis sense.
Tolkien. So the way I think of it, and I don't know exactly how they would explain it, but here's the way I think of it. Myth is, if you look at a famous painting, a great painting, or an amazing book that somebody wrote that's a novel, what you see is they saw something out in the world that was true and good and beautiful, and they distilled that and they brought it down into something that you can put in front of yourself and sort of almost at will look at, or almost at will digest and read. That is what I would call myth.
Yeah. So what's an example? Because again, I can understand that, but like, give us an example. Like, what's an example of something maybe within like just American culture that you think is pointing at a myth? Yeah.
Let's pull on J.R.R. Tolkien there. You know, The Lord of the Rings has been, and this actually plays right into what I wanted to talk about next, so that's perfect. Lord of the Rings has been such a core part of the way people who enjoy fiction look at the world. It has been such a core part of our diet for so long. And the reason for that is that those stories, that good versus evil that Tolkien put in there, it's a very clear distinction. Even when you have characters that aren't perfectly good or perfectly evil, that overarching good versus evil is always present, always visible. And he goes into, you know, even though his story isn't like a perfect allegory or doesn't pull perfectly on anything, it's very much his invention, he still took a lot of the symbolism and a lot of the myth from the real world, and he brought it into his writing where it calls to us. And the stories that tend to last very long do exactly that. They touch something deep inside of us where God put that need for truth and beauty, and it speaks to us. And that, I would say, is a perfect example of myth in the modern world.
Yeah. Can you maybe kind of pull on, like, just go a little bit more specific in terms of, like, what's one element or, like, one element in Tolkien's, in Lord of the Rings that maybe does this?
One of the ones that always gets me is the Men of the West speech that Aragorn makes, right? Men of the West, there may be a day when the courage of men fails, when we break all bonds of fellowship. And the idea being that things get really bad in life, and that there may come a time when the courage of men fails and we don't manage to stand against evil. But that isn't this day. We will go fight. And that's essentially what he's pulling on. And if there is a guy who's listening to this to whom that doesn't, like, you know, exactly. Right. It's like, that is the core of myth. Tolkien managed to just absolutely reach out and grab us with that. Right.
Yeah. 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 To that exact point. I mean, I think there's a broader thing that anyone anywhere can appreciate, right? Like, you can, you know, he says that he's speaking to a group of men, and, like, he's motivating this group of men through the use of, like, rhetoric. He's repeating this phrase, you know, but it is not this day. And then he's like challenging them as men to be brave, to, you know, to face down this enemy. But then even more, again, there's layers to these things. And so even more as men of the West today, you know, like, as men of the West, we get it at it. Like, I mean, it hits us in a way that's even unique and deeper and more powerful. And more shocking, maybe, than it would just the even more broad thing. But again, to your point, like, the myth that he's pulling on, or, like, this universal theme of challenging men to be brave, to face down terrible enemies at, you know, maybe low odds of success, and you're giving your all to overcome them and to rescue those and save those who you love, is this, you know, I wouldn't say primal, but this, like, it's this deeply seated thing.
Primal's
that
a good word for it.
Operate under. Yeah.
Primal's a really good word for it. And so for me, when I look at guys like Lewis and Tolkien, they were, in some sense, some of the last great creators of myth in Western culture. And they died 80 years ago, 60 years ago. You know, we're getting on. And since then, what do we see that counts as myth? We have Star Wars, Harry Potter, Dune, Game of Thrones. That's what we want to be. That's what we want to be looking to for our myth.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has become sort of twisted and narcissistic and at a base level, nihilistic.
Yeah.
One example of that, this is one that it isn't a perfect example, but it's one that I kind of ran into. How many modern stories do you know of where the dragon is the bad guy instead of the good guy?
Dragon is the bad guy instead of the good guy.
Since Tolkien.
So where would you say dragons are the good guys? Are you thinking, like, How to Train Your Dragon? You thinking, like...
I'm thinking that you can look at just about any modern story, whether it's, you know, in Harry Potter, they're kind of pets or beasts. But in any modern story, the dragons tend to be the good guys. Ride the dragon. The dragon is your familiar. It's your friend. It's your...
Sure.
You know, it's a powerful force for good or whatever.
Yeah.
Who's the dragon, Jordan? In reality, who's the dragon?
Let's say, not a good guy. We don't want to be there.
Right. Well, and what I'm saying here is without us even noticing, that myth sort of flipped.
Yeah.
It went from being where the dragon is the bad guy, St. George and the dragon. We kill the dragon.
To being
the dragon is the good guy. Yeah. And do you really think that's accidental?
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. No, I definitely see where you're going. At the same time, the small pushback would be,
yeah,
like the potential pushback would be, so in Genesis, like God tells Adam and Eve to exercise dominion and rule over all of the animals. And so what he's telling them is, I want you to say to the animals, let God's kingdom come, let his will be done. So I want you to inflict your will on these creatures so that they obey you and then ultimately me.
Right.
And so the one pushback that I could potentially see would be, you know, when Harry Potter, or when Harry and Hermione and Ron, you know, hop on this dragon who does not necessarily want to be ridden.
Right.
They hop on his back and, you know, like they're, I guess maybe even this way, this isn't even the best example, but like they're, I mean, because the dragon just is kind of leaving. He's kind of breaking out to go do his thing and they're just kind of along for the ride.
Right.
But like, yeah, I guess in the case of How to Train Your Dragon, that's a more symbiotic, you know, you have working with the dragon is seen as this beneficial thing. Whereas in the scriptures, you see working with and negotiating with the dragon, you know, being on the same team, you know, yeah, the result is destruction and death. So I think I agree with you more than I think you're very right to point that out in a lot of ways. So,
well, and that was just an illustration. I mean, you can go any number of other directions with it. It's like the one value of Harry Potter is like love or something. It's like it's mm-hmm. this amorphous thing. It's not, there is a being, an all-powerful being who is directing the world to whom we are, you know, it's love. And then mm-hmm. in the books, all Harry does is essentially rebel against what he is told to do, and he gets rewarded for it over and over again. And then you get to Game of Thrones, and we don't even need to talk about how twisted that is if you don't want to. I didn't actually watch any of it because it's just bad. I read the first book, and by the end of it, I'm like, this is so twisted, I don't want to put it in my head.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and this is the thing, is like, there's things where you're like, oh, there's myth here, but like at the same time, you're like, but at what cost? like there's,
right,
you know, like, yeah, I think some of the things with Harry Potter, again, I think Harry Potter, we could do a whole episode on like how like maligned by Christians Harry Potter. Like, I just think there's so much good in Harry Potter. It's mind blowing.
Sure.
And just so,
sure.
Yeah, like, I just think like,
what I'm pointing to though is just that compared to like Lewis and Tolkien, the value there is so minimal. I mean, I do like Harry Potter. I enjoyed it. I loved it growing up. You know, it was one of my favorite stories. But by the same token, the level of value that you see in the things that are capturing the collective consciousness lately is just going down. And that's the illustration that I'm trying to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like maybe we'll have you back and we'll do a whole episode of Harry Potter.
Sure.
It's like, my thing is just like I look at it and I'm like, okay, literally they quote 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 15 is on the tombstone of Harry's parents. And it's like, says the final enemy is death. And it's just like, I'm like, you can't get much more, you know, Christian and clear than like identifying, like, you know, equally identifying, like, exactly agreeing with God about the final enemy to be defeated. And just even the way it goes down, like there's so many things. There's the scene in the cave where they, like, the scene in this, sorry, Harry Potter spoilers for those who for those who maybe haven't, you know,
well,
haven't read
it
in
out
the movie
for what, 15, 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah. But no, there's a scene in the cave where they're trying to round up all these things to kill the bad guy, Voldemort. And they get to this point where he's hidden pieces of his soul to keep him from being able to be killed all over the world. And so they go into this cave and there's this drink that there's this cup that, like, basically they have to drink the contents in order to get access to this little piece to kill it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when else do we see maybe in scripture where someone has to drink effectively what amounts to like a cup of wrath in order to, you know, defeat the great enemy? It's like, it's literally, you know, Christ talks about, like, he drank the cup of the Father's wrath, or the Old Testament describes it as being a cup of wrath. And so I just think, like, there's a lot more there, you know, there's a ton there. But again, Do I think about it on the same level as I do Tolkien? No, I don't appreciate him to quite the same degree.
Or Lewis.
Yeah.
Well, Lewis is kind of on another.
Well, Tolkien didn't even like Lewis as well. Like Tolkien thought Lewis was too on the nose. He's like, you know, sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. You're too on the nose. You need to be more vague and, you know, be more, you know, not quite as obvious about what you're doing. But yeah, I just think like J.K. Rowling, like she's come out and basically saying, yeah, this book is based on the Christian faith. Like, you know that, like you start to pick up on it a lot, you know, a lot more than maybe you were initially expecting to.
Sure. And I mean, leave it to me to pick the one example you love instead of like going straight to Game of Thrones or something, which
exactly.
I don't know how much you know about that. But like I say, I read the first book and I went, this is so awful. They are glorifying evil in every possible way. And my whole point here is just to say that the stories that have captured the popular imagination over the past, you know, 50 years have gotten progressively more and more screwed up.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely think I absolutely agree with that. And I think you would agree with this. I think at the same time, what happens is in order to tell good stories, you have to agree with God to a certain extent. There is a structure that will produce, there's a structure that God has made the world to operate under that like, and made people to operate under that is attractive. And that is in a very real sense, pretty defined. You can't just go riffing off of things. And so that's why to give you an example, like this is, you agree with all this, but just for the audience's sake,
sure.
Like, you know, you've got something like, you have all these little postmodern art house movies that come out and they say, just some of the most wicked things ever. They don't necessarily have to be like full of sex and, you know, drugs and murder, but like some of the most, just awful messages that you can imagine are painted in some of these little tiny art house movies. Now, why do they end up staying tiny art house movies?
Because they don't resonate.
They do not resonate. They're so subverting what we all know to be true that there's only a very small group of people who in many cases are themselves horribly twisted who appreciate them and who like enjoy them to the same degree. So I think that's kind of what you're getting at, right?
That's absolutely what I'm getting at. And so here's the way I would tend to wrap this into a more modern way I look at the world.
Yeah,
we know that politics is downstream of culture, right?
Ooh, let's go.
That's okay. Culture is downstream of faith, meaning the things that we believe shape the way we live. The way we live determines the playing field politics is played on.
Yes.
Yep. Myth lives between faith and culture. It points back to the faith that we stand on, and it points forward to lead the way for the culture.
I like it. I like it. I'll take it.
So, I have a podcast too. It's Modern Apocrypha.
Oh, yeah.
And the intro to that podcast, I'm just going to read this real quick because this plays right into, and I think you're going to like this.
Do it.
Okay. In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions cannot be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of my heart. That's sort of what I wanted to do when I started writing these books.
Yeah.
And so to me, as a writer, there are three important things that you have to do and one that you can't do. Okay. So the first thing you have to do is to tell a fun, engaging story, right? That's like the core of your job. Your job is not to preach, which is the thing you can't do, right? It's the way I hear it is your right to preach is directly proportional to and less than your ability to tell a good story. The first thing your Yeah, right? So the first thing you have to do in a story is to tell a good story. And the second thing is we put part of ourselves into the story and into the characters because that gives people value and it draws them in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the experiences that we have that are really shape us, that are the core of who we are things that we try to put into our characters to draw other people in and to give them sympathy and to provide them some value through, you know, sort of sympathetically through experiences we've had. And then the third thing that we try to do is, you know, I talked about myth and what that is. The third thing we try to do is to pull in that myth, that truth that's out there in the world, and to distill it in a way that is useful to people or that they can kind of grab onto. And that is what makes a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I agreed that I just literally got back from this weekend from doing like a writing intensive on a kid's book that I'm writing. And so this is all, it's just, okay. It's pretty appropriate. So I'm like, awesome. In terms of like character development and all this kind of stuff. So, it's really good.
So for me, at least, if you don't mind, if I get into a little bit of just what I did with this story.
Actually, here, before you get into it, when I was going to ask you, are you familiar with like Jonathan Peugeot?
Yeah, I know who Jonathan Peugeot is.
So like because he would agree. I mean, like he's written, like his website is like The Symbolic World. He's written, you know, a ton on these topics too. And like finding.
Well, you know, one of the ways that I actually sort of got another window into this, one of the things that got me sort of a more substantial way to think about it was listening to Jordan Peterson. And I actually made it clear through his Maps of Meaning, I agree. And
the other one I was going to ask you about is, have you read anything by Louis Marcos?
I don't think so. I'll have to make a note of that.
Yeah. It's just Louis, I think it's he's Greek. So it's Marcos. I think I have one of his books somewhere. Basically, he just basically goes through a lot of like Western canon and just basically pulls out, it's something about myth made fact or something like that. I think it might be what it's called. It's pulling up very similar themes, but go ahead and unpack some of the things that are maybe within your work.
Okay, so what C.S. Lewis did in Chronicles of Narnia was to basically write an allegory. He kind of told the story of Christ over again, and I didn't feel quite competent to do that in a modern context. So instead, what I decided was, well, let's take a Christian, someone who is a believer, and put them in another world, a completely different world, just like Narnia, sort of, right? It's a different universe. And in that universe, they have to play a similar role to what Christ did here. Not for forgiveness of sin, but to fix a problem that was brought into the universe from outside of it that only someone from outside can fix. But in doing so, basically, Marcus Aurelius said that what we do echoes in eternity. And if that's true, then what Christ did is going to echo more loudly than anything else. So
let's go.
Yeah. So the my main character is essentially living out a parallel, an echo of Christ's story, but he's doing it as a flawed human being, as a Christian, as someone who believes in God to fix the problems in the world that he is inhabiting in his new world. And so the idea is you get to tell the story of what it is to be a Christian, but also in a sense to echo the story of Christ in the work. And to me, that was, it seemed like trying to do that was the best thing I could aspire to.
Yeah. That's awesome. No, again, that's really, and I know just how challenging that is. Again, like we're doing something very similar with the kids' book we're writing, but it's challenging. You don't want to be, again, finding the balance of, you don't want to beat people over the head. It has to be, it has to be, you know, real, but underhanded enough to where, you know, again, it doesn't come across preachy, because like that's right. so much of like the Old Testament. I mean, again, to your point, to, in defense of your greater point, like you have people, again, God has made all of us to be different types of people with different strengths and weaknesses for different purposes.
Yep.
And so, you know, you have people who are very, you know, you have people who are much more nonfiction, like oriented. Yeah. Give me nonfiction. I don't have time for fiction. You know, I just want to know what to do. You know, I want to put into practice these things. And so, and especially in the Christian realm, you know, those people, especially on this side of the cross, you know, you're like, okay, give me Paul's epistles. You know, give me the epistles. Yeah. Here. They're nice and clean. They're nice and yeah. clean and easy to understand. And it's easy for them to kind of read those expectations and desires back into even the Gospels. And you know, the Gospels are far more, they're far more interestingly arranged than, you know, just simply give me the facts like that. They had different priorities. Yeah, exactly. There's much more narrative creation going on there than just simply New York Times, give me the news.
Yeah.
But where they have maybe struggle is when you start going back into the Old Testament and you don't have this like, what's the phrase? You don't have just like explicit tellings of truth of like, here's the truth, now do this. It's much more, you know, these things are being told in narrative form. And an overwhelming percentage of the Bible is written in that way, and so if God sees fit to communicate through this medium of, you know, seemingly you could argue like unclear through an unclear medium or a less clear medium, like then it should give us pause about objecting to it or it should give us pause about neglecting it in favor of always wanting to go towards the propositional.
I actually think something I've been saying on a sort of a nonfiction level lately to people, this occurred to me a while back. God didn't give us a systematic theology. He gave us a set of narratives with some amount of propositional truth that's included in it, but he gave us a narrative. And that should tell us something about ourselves. It should tell us that's what we respond to. That's what we need. That's what actually motivates us, because God knows what we need. So the fact that we didn't get a systematic theology and we means we shouldn't try to propositionalize everything. Instead, we should live the story that he's put us in.
Yeah.
And, you know, systematizing things has its place, and I appreciate it for what it is, but when you give it too much weight, you tend to get lost. You tend to get into things that don't actually bear good fruit in your life.
Yeah, agreed. And this is, I think, one of the things that makes me think of is, you know, like the Pharisees of Jesus's day, right? Like they had so systematized, they took this law, which was a law, like, but they just systematized it and like added laws upon laws upon laws upon laws, to the point that they put so many things between the people and the law that they couldn't even see the wisdom and couldn't appreciate the goodness of the law and the beneficial nature of the law, because there were so many layers of unhealthy, just oppressive things, you know,
oppressive
put on top
rules.
Of it. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't see the story, to kind of pull on the thread that you're talking about. You couldn't see the story underneath of it.
Right. Well, and it's like I say, we actually have a tendency to do that in modern day too. And what it results in is what my uncle calls gorging on the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where you go into church and what they're looking at is they're looking at rights and wrongs. They're looking at where are we sinning? Where are we screwing up?
Yeah.
That's gorging on the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, instead of going back to the fact that Christ gave us this freedom as those who believe in him are now free to live as he directs us to do, to follow him, to go further up and further in, as C.S. Lewis would say.
Let's go. Yep. No, I love it. I think it is very true. And again, like, what is motivating that? Like, ironically, I would, and I think you would agree with this, it's worldliness that's motivating that. Like, which it's a weird form of worldliness, because what I mean by that is, mm-hmm. again, we have the spirit of our age that very, like, that highly, like, we value specificity, clearly outlined, detailed, all these things.
Yep.
And so, like, that itself is a point at which, like, we need to challenge with the gospel, with the scriptures, because again, like, if you don't, again, you start to judge the scriptures because they don't play by the rules that our culture, you know, by the rules and the values that our culture appreciates and loves here in 2024 now.
Okay.
And it's just easy for us as modern Christians and whatever, to like stand in judgment, or maybe be either stand in judgment of the scriptures or be a little bit embarrassed of the scriptures, because the scripture doesn't give us, you know, at 9:34 a.m., Mary and Joseph arrived in Bethlehem, and Jesus was born 7 seconds afterward. You know, like, the scripture doesn't
give us how many pounds and how many ounces now?
You think, oh, it doesn't give us that? Well, then it must not be true. It must not be reliable. And so it's
right.
just like...
And I think that what that demonstrates, at least to me, is that the core truths that are important in the world are not generally propositional. They're more structural. And the way to expose them, the way to find them, is actually to tell a story and to examine the things that come through that story.
Yeah.
And that's what we see in the Old Testament all over and over again.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah. No, 100%. That you see it all through the Old Testament. You see through the New Testament, on into the New Testament. But again, I just think it's more challenging in some ways. Like, again, it's easy if you're expecting, God just wants me to know what to do. Like, what he wants is, like, he's outcome-based. and God is outcome-based in a sense. But, like, if you're just, like, all God wants me to do is push the right button. He wants me to figure out which button to push. And, you know, you're going to have a truncated and, you know, less than complete view of who God is and what he wants. Like, God is very much about the process.
Well, the perfect way to explain God is as a father. He is our father. He wants us to grow up to be strong, healthy individuals as human beings. Yeah. And that means we need this rounded character. It isn't about following a set of rules. It's about learning the core, what would you call it? The core substance of what it is to be a good, strong person. That's where he's got us aimed.
Yes. Yeah. And I think this bears itself out in, I'm thinking where Paul, he talks about, like, let your conduct among the Gentiles be pure, you know, and he's putting a lot of emphasis on their character because he's like, he understood and he understands that the Christian character is going to, like, it's going to speak in ways, it's going to gain a credibility and gain a hearing in ways that maybe even the message itself sounds too insane. And so I think one example of this would be Paul and Silas with the Philippian jailer. So the jail breaks down and, like, crumbles, and the Philippian jailer is going to go kill himself because he's like, surely all these guys have ran away. And Paul and Silas are like, hey, don't harm yourself. We're all still here.
Yeah.
And so the Philippian jailer recognizes that, you know, the character of these men, like, it's just otherworldly. He doesn't know how to account for it, and so he falls down and becomes a Christian.
Yeah.
Just as a result.
And that's what he wants to instill in us, right? And so when you take it from there and try to make it about rules, you lose the plot. Literally, you lose the plot.
Yes, literally. Oh, man. So did you read? Yeah, I quote that phrase, losing the plot, like 3 or 4 times in this tax piece that I just published the other day, or the passage, the render to Caesar passages.
Did I read that one? I don't know. I read a couple of them, but the reason I actually use those words, though, is because we're talking about myth and story. And
yes,
so
100%. Yeah.
It just pulls in perfectly. It's exactly right, you know?
Yes.
And so my goal, my intent, my hope is just to encourage people to to see the wider truths and to find the more central threads of what God wants of us, and hopefully to pull the myth, you know, to contribute whatever I can to pulling the myth in our society back towards something that is Christ-centered and Christ-focused. Because, as I say, you know, he is the true myth. He is the center of all of the story.
Amen. Amen. Well, here, so we're nearing the end of our time here. Why don't you go ahead and give, remind everybody the name of your podcast and then the name of the books that are getting ready to come out here so that we can be hopping at Amazon and purchasing them.
Oh, that would be very much appreciated. Though I have to say, if you can, purchase them from somebody more local, you know, well, you know, it's a Bitcoin value, right? Buy local, get things from people who you can support, to whom it's going to matter. So
love it.
Okay. So podcast, modernapocrypha.com. The podcast is Modern Apocrypha. You can find me on Twitter at Modern Apocrypha. And then the books are the first book is Bright Star by Jared and Misho. My website is e6universe.com. I actually have an e-arc open right now for people who'd like to read an advanced copy. It's only a little bit longer, but if people are interested, they could get that for a few more weeks. And then after that, you know, you can get it probably. I'm actually published through a traditional publisher, so you will able to get this at whatever bookstore you would tend to buy books from. If they don't have it on the shelves, you can ask them and they can get it, and they'll make a decent profit too. So that's great. Go to a local
bookstore. Who's the publisher?
It's actually, the publisher is Morgan James Publishing, and off air, I'll tell you where I got the publisher from, because you'll go, Oh,
no way. Okay.
Okay. So actually, let me tell the story real fast, because this is a cool Bitcoin story too.
Do it.
There were two guys on Twitter that I asked to help me with this when I first started writing it. One of them was Field Nass Hammond of Texas. Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. I asked him to be a beta reader for me. He said, sure, I'll do that. And it turns out he has been about the coolest beta reader you could ask for. He's amazing. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, he has been both my greatest cheerleader, and he's helped me to find some of the real weak points in it, which
awesome.
I was super thankful for. And he's done such a great job. Okay. The other one, I asked Untapped Growth if he would read it when I finished and maybe recommend it if he liked it. And he's like, you know, my uncle's a publisher, right? I'm like, wait, what?
That's awesome. What a small world.
Oh man. So yeah, And I hope I don't think he cares that much. His name's out there if you know where to look.
So. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm not doxing anybody there, but
yeah.
So that's where I found it. So Morgan James Publishing is the publisher, and it's, I guess you would say it's kind of all in the family in a way, right? It's
man, that is so cool. Well, hey, congrats on finishing the first book. When is is it already at print, and when can we buy it?
It's due to hit shelves April 16th.
Okay.
Like I say, I'm doing an e-arc right now in preparation just to try to get the word out, because as a brand new author with no audience, it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
The book hits shelves April 16th, but if you're interested in buying a physical copy, you can buy one right off the website, e6universe.com.
Oh, perfect.
I'm actually selling them out of my house here for anybody who would like one.
Okay.
So, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you, dude. Again, congratulations. Again, that process is not easy, and it takes forever. And but I'm pumped for you and excited to see where this goes. And then when's the book two? You mentioned you had another one that's almost out.
So I sent in over 100,000 words, and they're like, YA fiction. We want to publish something closer to 50,000. I'm like, okay. So I chopped it in half and rewrote the story arc a little bit, which fit okay because it was episodic anyway. It wasn't a big deal to do that. And so I have a second book already written, and I can't basically, the way they want to do it is they want to wait a year after the first one comes out to publish the second one in the series. And I'm like, okay, so if you really like the first book, go bug the publisher. Make them let me publish it sooner. That's funny.
Well, cool, man. Jared, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And again, this will not be the last time we have you on. There's too much overlap for this to be the
last
time.
Oh, man, I sure appreciate it. I've been wanting to have this conversation. Thank you for doing it with me. I appreciate it. And I'm going to have you on my podcast now, too.
Oh, man, I would love to. And again, just in closing, I want to just remind everybody that you can get your tickets. I don't know if, Jared, are you going to be able to come to TGFB 24 in Nashville?
I would really love to. Actually, let's talk a little off air.
Cool. Yeah. So TGFB 24 is going to be our conference coming up July 24th and 25th in Nashville. You can get your tickets right now at tgfb.com/store. Tickets are going to go up, I believe. I think it's February 1st is what we decided. I could be wrong. I think it's February 1st. Tickets are going to be going up. So grab your tickets online now. Bring your family, your pastors, you know, missionaries, whoever it is. We're going to be doing a lot of different things, just geared around helping the church understand just all of the different value propositions of Bitcoin and economics more broadly. So, again, grateful for you guys for all of your listenership. I've gotten a number of just private messages the last few days that were just incredibly encouraging. You know, hey, thank you so much for doing this podcast. We really appreciate it. I've really benefited from it. And so again, we appreciate that. One thing that you can do to help us is go ahead and leave us a review on, either Apple's the most prominent, or Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We hardly have any reviews at this point. And so leaving us, if you think we deserve it, like a 5-star review is a hugely helpful thing in terms of getting sponsors, in terms of, spreading the word about the podcast. So
I'll second that. It is tremendously helpful having those reviews.
Awesome.
Go do it.
Yes.
Go review it.
Yes. Yeah, it helps you with the algorithm as well, and that's outside of our control. So, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, that would be a huge thing. So, again, Jared, great to meet you, and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds great, man. Thank you.